This is the second interview with General Earl J. Wheeler, Earl G. Wheeler, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And today is Thursday, May 7th, 1970, and it's about 10:45 in the morning. And we are in the General's offices in the Pentagon, and this is Dorothy Pierce McSween. General, we were discussing Vietnam at the end of our last interview, and I would like to conclude that subject with two events in 1968 which have had extensive coverage. The first being the Tet Offensive. And I would like to ask you to tell me a little bit about Mr. Johnson's decisions arising from this event and how they were reached, and any disagreement that you might have with the extensive material that's been written about the subject.
Well, to start off with, the Tet Offensive began about the 31st of January. We'd had a great deal of intelligence, captured documents, prisoners of war, defectors, which indicated that in starting in early January that something sizable was imminent. I recall receiving messages from General Westmoreland outlining various indicators, intelligence indicators, which led him to believe that the enemy was going to attempt something of a sizable nature. First, he was thinking of after Tet. Then, as I recall it, he was thinking of before Tet, which had happened in previous years. I would say that no one really expected the enemy to launch the attack during Tet, because, as you know, this is a very sacred time to the Vietnamese, all Vietnamese, North and South. It's a sort of a culmination of Christmas, New Year's, Easter. And I've been told by Vietnamese or Southeast Asian experts that this period of family reunification, celebration, hasn't been violated in over 300 years until 1968. So, while we knew something was going to happen, we didn't know exactly when, nor did we know how extensive the attack was going to be. As it turned out, the enemy launched very substantial attacks against most of the provincial capitals and against Saigon itself. They actually managed to introduce sizable forces into the environs of Saigon and into Hue, which is the old capital of Vietnam, and in which is located the most sacred pagoda in all of Vietnam. Now, the interesting part, historically it seems to me, of the Tet Offensive, is the fact that while it was militarily a very substantial defeat for the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, it was turned into a propaganda victory for the North Vietnamese here in the United States. And I attribute this primarily to the press coverage that was at that time, and to the dissident groups here in the United States who were following the Hanoi line and had been before that. I went out to Vietnam late in February, about the 24th, at the direction of President Johnson to survey the situation and ascertain the facts and to make any recommendations that I saw fit to make. When I got there, I conferred with General Abram, with General Westmoreland, all of his senior commanders at various times. I, of course, conferred with Ambassador Bunker and the mission staff. And you recall the embassy had been attacked. And as an illustration of the accuracy of the press coverage, the allegation was made that the Viet Cong had actually entered the embassy, which they did not do. They got into the embassy grounds through the wall, but they didn't get into the embassy at all. And I also had long conversations with General Diem, the chief of the Vietnamese Joint General Staff, with President Hugh, and the president, the vice president, Key. Now, the situation that I found was this. It being Tet, a substantial number of the South Vietnamese units were only at half strength because, following the Vietnamese tradition, they had returned to their homes on leave for the Tet holiday. The propaganda put out by the enemy captured PWs, defectors, and captured documents, made very clear what the enemy objectives were. And they apparently believed that they could achieve these objectives. First, they wanted to fragment and destroy the South Vietnamese armed forces. Secondly, they wanted to instigate uprisings in the major population areas against the government. Thirdly, they wanted to destroy our logistic base and our command and control system. And they had actually made a very sizable attack against Tansen at Air Base, where our command headquarters is located. The situation was complicated by the fact that, of course, we were holding the outpost up at Khe Sanh. And there had been a lot of very adverse publicity about that here in the United States, the comparisons being made to Dien Bien Phu, and things like that. Now, General Westmoreland was well aware of the very, very heavy casualties that had been inflicted on the enemy. He was aware that the Vietnamese forces, in general, had remained intact and had fought extremely well. This included even some of the regional forces and the popular forces who are paramilitary and not regular forces. He was not aware, and he was aware, that up until that time, about the 24th, 25th, 26th of February, the Vietnamese government had not fallen apart at all. However, the enemy was propagandizing that they were going to undertake a so-called second wave of attacks. What he didn't know was, one, whether the South Vietnamese government would remain stable, could retain control if there was a second wave of attacks. Secondly, whether the South Vietnamese armed forces would remain intact and able to fight. And of course, thirdly, he had on his mind the problems connected with Khe Sanh, Northern I Corps, the battle that was going on in Hue, and so on. So, and his situation was further compounded by the fact that he did not know what had happened to the pacification program out in the hinterlands. We were getting very gloomy reports based upon we learned later to be fragmentary information, in most instances greatly exaggerated and inaccurate, because the enemy did not target the pacification program. He was going after the main population centers. He had already set his objectives, and this is probably where he made a mistake at least. General Westmoreland had to move forces from the south, that is from 2nd and 3rd Corps, to the north, up into the Da Nang Hue area, and along the DM, into the DMZ area, this is in I Corps, in order to get a proper balance of force within country. And he had absolutely no reserve, none. He had not a single American unit, nor was there a single Vietnamese unit that was not committed. And therefore, if there came a second wave of attacks, and if the Vietnamese forces began to disintegrate, he would have been left in a rather precarious position. Now, in assessing, one further point that's pertinent here. His troop ceiling at that time was 525,000. He had never received over 500,000. And we still owed him, you might say, another 25,000 troops. We had reinforced him in earlier, started to reinforce him in early February with the 3rd Brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division and with the 27th Marine Regimental Landing Team. And, of course, when they arrived, it gave him additional flexibility. So we discussed the situation at some length. Now, I had in the back of my mind a couple of other things. One, we had the attack on the Blue House, the President's Palace in South Korea in January. We had the capture of the Pueblo in late January. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff here were greatly concerned about those incidents, which had required us to deploy a very substantial number of American fighter units, fighter bomber units, tactical aircraft, to Korea in order to redress the imbalance between the South Korean Air Force and the North Korean Air Force. And we were unaware of what was going to happen. Our strategic reserve here in the United States was completely depleted. We had not a single unit that under the criteria that we had established, that is the 1 year in country, 2 to 2.5 years back here in the United States, was deployable. Not one that could be sent to Vietnam. The one that was closest to being ready was the 5th Mechanized Division Army, and it couldn't be ready even with one brigade for a period of about 6 to 8, 10 weeks. It was still in training. In discussing the situation with General Westmoreland, and as I say, with his command as a staff, we worked up a proposal in terms of units now, because we weren't thinking in terms of men and numbers, that would have provided him, as soon as we could get it to him, and he said he would like to have it in May, one division. And then we should prepare ourselves for future eventualities by having another division which would be deployable sometime in early September. And as a matter of prudence, we should have a 3rd division which possibly could have been deployed in, let's say, December of 1968. That is the proposals that I brought back with me from South Vietnam. I stopped in Honolulu and conferred with Admiral Sharp and his people. We went over the whole program. I had told General Westmoreland that I did not believe it was humanly possible to provide him a full division as early as May. This could not be done. We didn't have the forces to do it. But that we would see what we could provide. I stopped in Honolulu, as I say, conferred with Admiral Sharp and his people, and we began to work the problem then as to units, call up of reserves, increases in the draft, all the rest of it. And then when I got back here, I gave the Joint Chiefs of Staff a briefing, and we began to work the problem. I also briefed the President and the pertinent members of his cabinet and certain congressional leaders. Now, President Johnson at that time decided to establish this review group or committee or whatever you want to call it, which would be headed by Mr. Clark Clifford, who was then the Secretary of Defense designate, and which would have his members, of course, Mr. McNamara, as long as he remained around, Secretary Rusk, Mr. Helms of CIA, myself, General Max Taylor, and there were two or three others. I think Nick Katzenbach sat in from time to time also. And as I say, we on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, we began to work out the details of how to provide or where to get the forces which General Westmoreland and I had conferred about on the time schedule that we had conferred about. It soon became apparent from the JCS point of view that the only way these forces could be provided in a timely fashion would be by a very substantial call-up of reserves. And I believe that this ultimately became the sticking point because we called up some reserves, but not nearly as many as would have been required to produce the forces which we were contemplating, which would have been used, one, to reinforce in Vietnam, two, to reestablish the strategic reserve here in the United States so that we could meet contingencies either in Vietnam or in Korea or elsewhere. We were having problems in the Middle East as well at that time, as you know, and would give us some flexibility. There were a number of meetings at the White House. Mr. Clifford and I conferred with congressional leadership at great length. The matter of a reserve call-up was very, very onerous for any of these gentlemen to accept because of the political problem of considerable dimensions and heat. And progressively, what was proposed was whittled down. Now, one of the problems, of course, was the fact that certain individuals right here in the Pentagon at a very early date leaked all of the details of this to the New York Times, as you probably recall. And this generated the usual reaction that you get here in the United States, generated by people who are attempting to preempt the president and his decisions. And of course, this put Mr. Johnson under tremendous political pressure from various pressure groups. And while I don't think it tied his hands by any matter of means, it certainly must have had some influence on the decisions that were eventually made.
Did you have to give the names of those people?
No, I happen to know the names of at least one, and I have on good authority, but I'm not going to name him. I'll let the son of a bitch stew in his own juice, if you'll excuse the expression. He has been very forthcoming with his own ideas on this subject, I might add. So, anyway, we looked over the whole package, and after much discussion at the higher levels of government, it was decided that we simply could not go as far down the road for political and for fiscal reasons as would have been required to meet the overall program that had been laid out. Now, in military parlance, what I brought back was a contingency plan. In other words, the only firm request that Westmoreland really made was for the first increment. The second and the third increments would have been deployed only on the decision of the president in the light of circumstances that prevailed at the time. So, we finally came down with the thought that what we should do was, one, to give him the troop units that we still owed him. In other words, bring him up to 525. And in addition, we worked out a package that amounted to another 24,500 support troops of various kinds, which would have made his troop ceiling 549.5. Now, I flew out to Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines on the 24th of March, and I met with General Westmoreland and discussed this whole thing with him most of one night. He told me that this was entirely satisfactory to him, recognizing the problems here in the United States. And his reasons were these. First, the second wave of attacks had not eventuated. What had happened was that the North Vietnamese and the VC had taken, really, a terrific military defeat. Their losses had been tremendous. Moreover, in the process of generating this offensive, they had surfaced a considerable number, in fact, the majority, of the VC infrastructure, the political leaders, the military leaders, and so on, and they had either been killed or captured during the course of the offensive. The pacification program had suffered a setback in several areas, but nothing nearly as bad as had been reported and feared at the time. The Arvin was was stronger. They had gained assurance from the fact that they had withstood the North Vietnamese. And the Vietnamese government was stronger, in a stronger position than they had ever been. And this was evidenced by the fact that we had been urging upon them a general mobilization before this, and they had never felt politically strong enough to do it. Westmoreland likened the Tet Offensive to being the Battle of the Bulge, insofar as the North Vietnamese and the VC were concerned. And in other words, they shot their wad on that militarily and were never able to do anything much of a sizable nature after that. And he said, as far as the South Vietnamese was concerned, it was sort of like Pearl Harbor, because it really awakened the people and the government and got them off the dime and moving ahead in order to, you might say, protect themselves. The South Vietnamese also, the South Vietnamese people, were extremely angry at the VC because they had violated Tet and the North Vietnamese. See, this was really a traumatic experience for them, from the religious point of view, from the family point of view, and so on. And also, whereas in the past the VC had posed as being the great liberators and protectors of the people, they murdered people right and left. As you probably know, at least 3,000 civilians were lined up in Hue, up near Hue, and either killed or buried alive in mass graves. We found them. And the South Vietnamese knew all of this, and many people who before had either been lukewarm or had given credence to the VC claims to be the protectors of the people no longer believed them. So that's the story of the Tet Offensive. In other words, Westmoreland said he was perfectly satisfied with the 549-5, that he could do the job, he could carry on because of the changed situation. One further item before I leave this. Also, he was in the process of that at that time. You see, Hue had been recaptured and liberated by that time. He was in the process of mounting an operation to relieve Khe Sanh, which he did in early April. And then he was going to move into the Ashau Valley, which is a VC stronghold on the border of Laos and South Vietnam, and clean it out, because it had been the source of a lot of the supplies and many of the troops that had been used in Northern I Corps in this way. So that's the story of the 200,000 of the Tet Offensive.
General, you've gone into a little bit, part of my second question, which was the 68 policy review, but I wanted to bring it up to the result of that review, which was President Johnson's March 31st speech and the military decision at that time of the troop ceiling and the restriction on the bombing.
Well, the troop ceiling was established at 549-5, I would say, about, I met with Westmoreland on the 24th of March. The final decision on that troop ceiling and what we could and would provide was made perhaps the 20th of March or the 19th, or something like that, before I went to Vietnam. I was only gone a day and a half. I flew out to the Philippines and flew right back. And when I got back, why, I found that there was discussion going on about a partial bombing plan to the 20th parallel. And there's a great deal of discussion about this. From the military aspect, the JCS had to agree that insofar as affecting the situation in South Vietnam substantially, a bombing halt on March the 31st would have very little influence on the battlefield operations in the South. The reason being that the weather at that time of the year in North Vietnam is atrocious, and you just can't do any decent bombing anyway. So it had very little effect one way or the other. Now, what led President Johnson to this, I do not know.
Is there a great disagreement here, sir, and polarization between
the president has told me, President Johnson has told me, that Dean Rusk was the man who first advanced the idea of the partial bombing law as an effort to get negotiations started. I know that other people have advanced the idea that that they were the heroes who thought of this. I'll let anybody who wants to have the credit for it. I did not suggest it. This I know.
Did you see a great effort to sway the president's mind?
No, because I was gone during a part of the time that this was going on. And I think that by the time I returned and it was first broached to me, he had already made up his mind that he would make this offer in the speech of March the 31st, or at least had almost made up his mind. And the first time that I discussed it with him face to face was in company with General Abrams, whom I brought back with me from Clark Air Force Base, because he was going to relieve General Westmoreland. Westmoreland became Chief of Staff of the Army in July of 68. He asked, President Johnson asked, our opinion of the Chief of Staff, Joint Chief of Staff, and General Abrams, as to what the, and General Westmoreland, what the effect would be. And we had, in all honesty, to tell him it would have very little effect on what happened in South Vietnam.
Thank you. Something else that went through my mind. Let me continue on with the last part of the president's speech, in which he withdrew from re-election. Did you have any indication of this before that announcement?
I can't honestly say that I did. The only thing that I recall that struck me at the time, because I was present at some of the drafting sessions on his speech to include the night before he made it. And I could tell that he was in more of a swivet than I'd ever seen him before in my life. He was really very much concerned about something. His manner was completely different than he usually was. And he was obviously upset emotionally, and I would say mentally. And as I say, this was not his usual demeanor, and I thought to myself at the time that that he was just awfully tired. I knew he was tired. He was damn near exhausted, as a matter of fact. An interesting sidelight is that, I guess it was Sunday preceding the speech, they sent me the final draft, but it had no ending. And the ending, he had reserved for himself to give, he told me this later, reserved for himself to give. In other words, he had waited until the very last moment so there would be no leaks, to put down on a piece of paper this proposal. But I mean, his statement, he would not seek re-election.
I know what I was thinking before, General, but it ties in with this. Do you think that this decision on the part of Mr. Johnson and the sort of turning the corner of the Vietnam War in the speech of March 31st in setting these various limitations and restrictions, did it result from the propaganda victories of Tet, or is it just the time sequence?
No, I tell you, I think his decision was something that he had been considering for a long time. And the reason is that you could actually see him getting older by the month during the 4 years after he was elected president. He worked terrifically hard. I mean this, terrific worker. Apparently he was greatly worried about the dissent in the country, what was going on in the country, the problems of dealing with the various world situations that kept hitting him in the face. I also believe that Mrs. Johnson was worried about his health, As you know, he suffered a very serious heart attack in 1956, and he wasn't exactly leading the kind of life that a man who's had a serious heart attack should be leading. And I have an idea that, I know from what he has told me since, that he had been giving consideration to this for well over a year. And in other words, it was a recurring theme. I think he may have even discussed it with certain of his very close friends. I also know that when General Westmoreland was back here in November, I think it was, late November of 1967, he asked General Westmoreland if this would have any, if he were not re-elected president, would this have any ill effect on the morale of the troops? And Westmoreland said that he thought that that the troops would understand it wouldn't have any profound effect. Of course, this was all conjectural. I mean, when he was talking to Westmoreland, he didn't tell Westmoreland, this is what I'm going to do. He was just talking about the morale of the troops in general and the prospects of the future and that kind of thing.
Before we close that subject, just quickly, are there any discrepancies you recall with what has now been written about these subjects and as you saw them yourself?
Well, there certainly is a discrepancy about the number of troops and the terms in which the request was made. There's a very vast discrepancy there, of course.
Yes, you have made that one clear. I'm sorry. Any others?
The stories that were written about what had happened in South Vietnam as compared to what had really happened, there's no resemblance of truth in the stories that were written and what actually went on. These are the two areas that strike me as being within my own competence to comment on.
Let me go a little bit forward to Mr. Johnson. Himself on the presidency, anything he might have told you on that, and then if there is any other time, I might get back to another question. What I'm thinking of in terms of how you saw the procedure that was followed at the White House and any comments Mr. Johnson made himself about the presidency or his presidency. This is a very broad question, and you'll pick up where you see it.
Mr. Johnson was used to operating in the congressional way. In other words, dealing with a group, a relatively small group of senior senators, and by personal persuasion and argumentation, and as he said, talking things out, arriving at a decision and then going ahead and pushing it through to legislation as might be required. So he operated when he was president very much in that same manner. The National Security Council meetings were held, of course, but he never really presented there or discussed there the major questions having to do with Vietnam. They were reserved very generally for the Tuesday luncheons. And as you probably know, the regular attendance at those luncheons were Secretary Rusk, Secretary McNamara, later Secretary Clifford, myself, Dick Helms, usually George Christensen would sit in, but he was the press secretary, but purely so that he would be aware of what was going on, and Walt Rostow. And occasionally, Vice President Humphrey would attend. From time to time, Justice Fortas would attend. Before he was Secretary of Defense, occasionally Clark Clifford would attend, and occasionally General Max Taylor would attend. As I say, the regular attendees were the smaller group that I just mentioned. And it was there that we thrashed out you might say, the details and the decisions as to what was going to be done with regard to the war in Vietnam. Now, at that same time, however, these same luncheons, he opened up much broader subjects than the war in Vietnam. He would discuss other problems, too, and domestic and foreign affairs, because the Secretary of State was there. So there would be a pretty wide-ranging conversation. And it was from these meetings, I think, that he derived the information and gave him the bases for the decisions, many of the decisions that he took.
Was this did this informality cause any difficulty in terms of the decision that was being reached, or had it been reached, or the necessary information on the subject?
No, at least not on the military side. I always, of course, at the first opportunity after, which would be Wednesday normally, we speak on Wednesday afternoon, I would always debrief them as to what went on, insofar as it affected the military. Now, I didn't get into other domestic problems and so on. I didn't think that, in fact, it wasn't our business. If it had something to do with our business, but of course I would mention it to them. So we had no problem in keeping up with it. It may have caused some problems in the other departments of government, I'm not so sure.
How would you rate, is it kind of a wrong word to use, but in order of their reoccurrence, the subjects that were covered in the Tuesday luncheons? I would assume Vietnam would be probably the one that was foremost.
Vietnam was foremost. We always talk about Vietnam. There's no question about that. The other subjects would range right across the board, from domestic politics to domestic problems, the budget, foreign policy problems such as those caused by the Arab-Israeli war, or the Arab-Israeli confrontation before the Arab-Israeli war, the problems having to do with North Korea and South Korea, you name it, it was discussed.
Okay. How would you describe the impact of the Vietnam War on Mr. Johnson?
Well, it was a very harrowing experience for him. For one thing, I am convinced that he wanted to go down in history as a peace president who devoted his time and his energies to development within the United States. This was absolutely sincere on his part. So he found himself a war president in a very difficult time to be a war president because of the dissent in the United States. And this, of course, was particularly abrasive to him. It was not a congenial atmosphere for him to live in. Now I know that some people have doubted his sincerity on many things. I personally don't doubt his sincerity on this at all. And I must say I spent more hours than I can remember of my life talking to him on subjects related to the war in Vietnam.
How would you describe Mr. Johnson's strengths and weaknesses?
Well, his strength is the fact that he is a very determined man, and a very dedicated individual, and dedicated to the well-being of the United States. He also, due to his long service in the Congress, understood understood precisely how to deal with the Congress. He not only knew many of them well, and had known them well for many years, they were personal friends, but even more than that, He understood the sensitive spots in congressional executive branch relationships and was able to deal with these very effectively. This was a tremendous advantage to him in getting his programs through. He took great pride, and I think rightly so, that in the remnant of President John Kennedy's office after Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, that he, Johnson, put through all of the legislative programs which Mr. Kennedy had been unable to get through the Congress during his tenure as president. And this, I believe, was due to his own political astuteness and political ability to deal with the Congress and the congressional leadership. His greatest weakness will probably sound odd to you, and this is the fact that he does not project well as a speaker, either on the public platform, on the TV, or the radio. He simply cannot project his own sincerity and his firm beliefs in various things. They just don't come through. At least they don't to me, and they don't to a great many other people that I have talked to.
Did he discuss that with you, sir?
Never. Except I know that he got to be a better speaker towards the end of his term than he was at the beginning, and I know that he was working at improving his ability to project. Now, the odd part of it is that in a small gathering, I'm speaking now of anywhere from 4 to 12 people, he made an entirely different impression. Entirely different. You realize when you were in this small group listening to him that here was a man of character and strength. It just came right out and hit you in the face. And yet, as over the TV tube, it didn't come out at all. He's a very remarkable man. He's an unusual man. He's a very sensitive man. And this is something that a lot of people don't give him credit for either. As I say, in my judgment, his greatest weakness was the fact he just did not project when he spoke publicly.
Are there any conversations that you recall that were really in a more of a, just a personal nature that particularly stand out and describe the president to you?
Well, yes.
We didn't cover this before, but if it is, I'd rather get it than not.
Well, I may have told you this before. I'm not sure, Mr. McSweeney, but I was over in Vietnam in July of 1967, and I apparently suffered what they call a silent heart attack climbing up a hill up in their Pleiku Cool one very hot afternoon when I was very tired. And in fact, it was picked up on me on a routine physical that I was taking in August. And about 4 or 5 weeks after it happened, apparently. Well, of course, I was in the hospital for a couple of weeks. They let me out on convalescent leave. And when I got out, I went to see President Johnson. And I told him what my physical condition was and what the prognosis was and so on, the fact that I was going to be out of action for at least another 6 weeks, and it could be considerably more than that. And I suggested to him that I should retire and that he should appoint somebody else as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Well, he talked to me for about 45 minutes, and finally he said to me, now, Bus, he said, Buzz, what he always called me, he said, you just go on off and do what the doctors tell you to do to improve your health. And he said, I don't want anybody else as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He said, but on the other hand, I don't want you to kill yourself in that job. And he said, after you've had another checkup in about 6 weeks or so, if the doctors say you can do the job, he said, I want you to stay on. And then we were in his office. This was, I don't know, 7:30 or so at night. He got up and walked to the door with me and put his arm around my shoulders and said, I can't afford to lose you. He said, you have never given me a bad piece of advice. I don't know what that's about President Johnson or about Wheeler.
Either way, it's fine. General, I'm noticing the time. Of course, could go on. I don't. Maybe you better cut it here.
What other question do you have?
Well, of course, as the military advisor to the president, I was going to get in the broadest question I possibly could about the Middle East and the Dominican intervention.
Well, I can answer both of those very quickly. Insofar as the Middle East goes, this is the war of 1967. Of course, the Israelis were, as you would expect, pressing very hard for additional military assistance in the form of aircraft, et cetera, et cetera. And you might say a commitment on the part of the United States that we were going to back them up to the hilt. Well, my part in this was relatively simple because President Johnson asked me at the end of one of these meetings what our estimate was as to the relative ability of the two sides. And I told him that our best estimate was that if there were a war, that the Israelis would win it in 5 to 7 days. And he asked me to go back and check this out and talk to him about it again, and I did, and I came back and told him exactly the same thing. That there's just no question but that the way the two sides lined up in the air and on the ground, that the Israelis would win. That if the Israelis preempted the UAR, the war would be shorter and their losses would be less than if the contrary happened and the Arabs had preempted the Israelis. This turned out to be reasonably correct, as you probably recall. On the Dominican Republic, there was a question of whether or not we should intervene. And largely, the problem centered around the political aspects as to whether, and also the intelligence as to whether or not this was a communist-inspired movement, rather than being, as some people in the United States would have it, merely an uprising of honest citizens who were highly indignant at what was going on in their country. I took part in all of those discussions. The president finally made the decision to intervene, and then it was a matter of merely getting the forces organized and moving them, giving them the proper orders and so on. And I recall there was some criticism because we put about 20,000 troops in there, which some people said was too many. And my only response to that was that you can never have too many. And that if you can overawe the enemy by a show of force, your casualties are going to be less. We could probably have done the job with fewer forces, but it would probably have cost us more in terms of lives than it did.
So you did see evidence of some sort of a communist influence in the Republic? And what about the Soviet threat in the Middle East war?
Communist threat? Well, the communist involvement in that was Soviet backing of the radical Arab states. You will recall that the United States, were trying desperately to get a diplomatic solution to that war. And we were meeting all sorts of resistance There's no question but what the very substantial Soviet backing given to the UAR in particular gave Nasser the feeling that he could push ahead.
Any worry about intervention on the part of the Soviet Union?
Not particularly. I never had any, because I didn't think that they would. I just it's contrary to their practice to intervene and things like that. So I never had. Of course, this was something you had to take into account. But it wasn't anything that really worried me a great deal.
How did Mr. Johnson act under these two particular crisis situations, as you would call them?
Well, I would say that he was deeply concerned. He was very firm on both occasions and knew very clearly what he was and was not going to do. In other words, he...
How did he reach that position?
Well, he sat down and talked to various people. He's a great one, you know, for talking to people. And he talks to people all over the country by telephone. And he gets in groups of people in the White House and talks to them. He talks to all of his normal advisors, and he finally makes up his mind that this is the thing to do, and he goes at it. One other aspect is that you asked me about strengths and weaknesses a while ago. I'll tell you another strength of his. He asks very intelligent questions. Very difficult questions on occasion to answer, because if you are talking to him and you're sort of dealing in generalities, he has a habit of waiting until you get through, and he says, "And so what? ? In other words, what is your conclusion? What is your recommendation?" So as I say, he asks very intelligent questions and sometimes very difficult questions.
Do you recall any particular instance of that?
On a number of occasions, but nothing specific. I mean, it's just you could never get by with a generality. You had to come down and say, this leads me to the following conclusion.
On the Middle East and the Dominican intervention, is there anything you could just conclude with on that? Or have we covered that?
No, I think that nothing stands out in my mind other than the fact that Mr. Johnson was determined, if possible, to avert a war in the Middle East. And he was also determined that he was not going to, as far as the Dominican Republic goes, that he was not going to see another island in the Caribbean become communist. Those two things.
General, I want to thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you for the
conclusion. Not at all.